So, good evening. Welcome to the 10th chapter, Knowledge by Identity and Separate of Knowledge. This is a chapter that Sri Aurobindo wrote to add to the revision that he was attempting of the Life Divine. You can see that as you examine the titles of the chapters that he's gone through building a case for the nature of reality, of its expression in the cosmos, of our experience of that reality, our place within it. What is the nature of our self-experience? Of what are we truly constituted? And now he moves from ontology to epistemology. What is the nature of knowledge? How do we know? And of course, he will find his point settled through the inner dimension, as we've seen him do in his other philosophic lucubrations, through the discipline of self-knowledge, through our own psychology, the nature of our own being, is the final determinant. Not some external source, but the route to a golden knowledge, both of self and world, is through our own experience of reality. It lies within us. And when we look at the selections that he's drawn from Vedantic sources, all of them speak to this. The mottos are drawn from the Gita, the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, and the Katha Upanishad. Let's take the first one. They see the self in the self by the self. This is from the 6th chapter in the Bhagavad Gita. Atmana, Atmanam, Pashyan, Atmani. The next is from the oldest of the Upanishads, so old that it's actually an Aranyaka, a forest treatise all by itself, a gigantic piece with many, many different teachings within it. This happens to be taken from that famous section where Yajñavalkya is revealing the secrets of the self to his wife, Maitreyi. Where there is duality, dvaitam, there other sees other. Other hears, touches, thinks of, knows other. But when one sees all, sarvam, as the self, atmaiva bhut, by what shall one know it? It is by the self that one knows all this that is. All betrays him who sees all elsewhere than in the self. For all this that is the Brahman. All beings in all this that is are this self. If that's the oldest of the Upanishads, the Katha Upanishad, which follows in this next selection, is younger, much younger. The self-existent, Swayambhu, has pierced the doors of sense outward, Paranchi. Therefore, one sees things outwardly and sees not in one's inner being, Antaratman, the inner self. Rarely a sage desiring immortality, Amritam, his sight turned inward, Avritta Chakshur, sees the self face to face, Pratyag Atmanam. So, by dint of the divine will, our gaze as we enter into the world is outward facing. We look through the senses to contact the world around. But in the eons, there are a few who wake up to the possibility of immortality, and they turn their sight inside, and they find the self, which is the basis of all. They encounter it, and they become it. The last is from the Brihadaranyaka again. This section is a little bit earlier. There is no annihilation of the seeing of the seer, the speaking of the speaker, the hearing of the hearer, the knowing of the knower, for they are indestructible. But it is not a second or other than and separate from himself that he sees, speaks to, hears, knows. Natu tadvitiyam asti. So that which inheres in the self does not go out of existence. But wisdom tells us that there is none other than the self, the Atman. And so he begins with an examination of what is our normal experience. Always he leads us from the near to the far. He begins. Our surface cognition, our limited and restricted mental way of looking at ourselves, at our inner movements, and at the world outside us and its objects and happenings, is so constituted that it derives in different degrees from a fourfold order of knowledge. In other words, our surface view is built from several elements, four different distinct avenues which reach knowledge into us. The original and fundamental way of knowing, native to the occult, a word that just means hidden, native to the occult self and things, is a knowledge by identity. The second, derivative, is a knowledge by direct contact, associated at its roots with a secret knowledge by identity, or starting from it, but actually separated from its source and therefore powerful but incomplete in its cognition. The third is a knowledge by separation from the object of observation, but still with a direct contact as its support or even a partial identity. The fourth is a completely separative knowledge which relies on a machinery of indirect contact, a knowledge by acquisition, which is yet, without being conscious of it, a rendering or bringing up of the contents of a pre-existent inner awareness and knowledge. A knowledge by identity, a knowledge by intimate direct contact, a knowledge by separative direct contact, a wholly separative knowledge by indirect contact, are the four cognitive methods of nature. The first way of knowing, in its purest form, is illustrated in the surface mind only by our direct awareness of our own essential existence. It is a knowledge empty of any other content than the pure fact of self and being. Of nothing else in the world has our surface mind the same kind of awareness. So we are aware first of the fact of our existence. and this exemplifies this kind of knowledge. This is apprehendable in our current lives. But in the knowledge of the structure and movements of our subjective consciousness, some element of awareness by identity does enter. For we can project ourselves with a certain identification into these movements. It has already been noted how this can happen in the case of an uprush of wrath, which swallows us up so that for the moment our whole consciousness seems to be a wave of anger. Other passions, love, grief, joy, have the same power to seize and occupy us. Thought also absorbs and occupies. We lose sight of the thinker and become the thought and the thinking. But very ordinarily, there is a double movement. A part of ourselves becomes the thought or the passion. Another part of us either accompanies it with a certain adherence or follows it closely and knows it by an intimate direct contact, which falls short of identification or entire self-oblivion in the movement. So you remember that example about the uprush of wrath as he discussed it in the last chapter. So he's dealing here in his first examples with the life affects tangible to us. To continue. This identification is possible, and also this simultaneous separation and partial identification, because these things are becomings of our being, determinations of our mind stuff and mind energy, of our life stuff and life energy. But since they are only a small part of us, we are not bound to be identified and occupied. We can detach ourselves, separate the being from its temporary becoming, observe it, control it, sanction or prevent its manifestation. We can, in this way, by an inner detachment, a mental or spiritual separateness, partially or even fundamentally liberate ourselves from the control of mind nature or vital nature over the being and assume the position of the witness, knower, and ruler. Witness, sakshi, knower, jnani, for one. Anumanta, ruler, sanctioner. Thus, we have a double knowledge of the subjective movement. There is an intimate knowledge by identity of its stuff and its force of action, more intimate than we could have by any entirely separative and objective knowledge, such as we get of things outside us, things that are to us altogether not self. There is at the same time a knowledge by detached observation, detached but with a power of direct contact, which frees us from engrossment by the nature energy and enables us to relate the movement to the rest of our own existence and world existence. So to this point, he's still talking about our subjective experience. He's not referring to the outside world. This is not our direct apprehension of ourself as being, but as a direct intimate movement, we are able to separate back from it and look at it, to regard it, whether it's a movement of our vitality or it's a movement of our thought. This is still within the subjectivity of ourselves. He continues, if we are without this detachment, we lose our self of being and mastering knowledge in the nature self of becoming and movement and action. And though we know intimately the movement, we do not know it dominatingly and fully. Dominatingly, suggesting that we have power. So when we can stand back from either the uprush of wrath, for example, or the absorbing thought, we can have power over it. We have a little psychological distance. We can command. We can direct. We have some freedom. But if we lose that detachment and just become that, then we don't have that same power and effective control of it. This would not be the case if we carried into our identification with the movement our identity with the rest of our subjective existence. If, that is to say, we could plunge wholly into the wave of becoming and at the same time be in the very absorption of the state or act the mental witness, observer, controller. But this we cannot easily do because we live in a divided consciousness in which the vital part in us, our life nature of force and desire and passion and action, tends to control or swallow up the mind, and the mind has to avoid this subjection and control the vital, but can only succeed in the effort by keeping itself separate. For if it identifies itself, it is lost and hurried away in the life movement. So this is the survival strategy that the mind has in dealing with an emotional vital nature. It has to maintain itself in its separativity to be able to partially control it. But he does suggest here that an integration is possible, that dissolving that separation would allow us to have both at once. The full identity and yet the control. This is not possible on the surfaces of our nature, but when we get back to deeper realms, it is fully possible for us to have that kind of regnancy. So he continues, nevertheless, a kind of balanced double identity by division is possible, though it is not easy to keep the balance. There is a self of thought, which observes and permits the passion for the sake of the experience, or is obliged by some life stress to permit it. And there is a self of life, which allows itself to be carried along in the movement of nature. So in a sense, you're getting the idea then that the self can support both the thought being and the life being. And how they interact is all the game. Here then, in our subjective experience, we have a field of the action of consciousness in which three movements of cognition can meet together. A certain kind of knowledge by identity, a knowledge by direct contact, and dependent upon them, a separative knowledge. So if we just look at our simple subjective experience, we can see how these three forms of knowledge are working within us. Let's continue. In thought, separation of the thinker and the thinking is more difficult. The thinker is plunged and lost in the thought or carried in the thought current, identified with it. It is not usually at the time of or in the very act of thinking that he can observe or review his thoughts. He has to do that in retrospect and with the aid of memory, or by a critical pause of corrective judgment before he proceeds further. But still, a simultaneity of thinking and conscious direction of the mind's action can be achieved partially when the thought does not engross, entirely when the thinker acquires the faculty of stepping back into the mental self and standing apart there from the mental energy, this bifurcation which becomes possible as we grow more and more into the witness self, even at the mental level, that witnessing is possible before getting back to the entire free state of the Purusha. Here he's speaking of the mental equipment. Instead of being absorbed in the thought, with at most a vague feeling of the process of thinking. We can see the process by a mental vision, watch our thoughts and their origination and movement, and partly by a silent insight, partly by a process of thought upon thought, judge and evaluate them. Well, I don't think we need to labor this to show that there is an analogy between this capacity of the thinker to observe his thoughts and the meditator to stand distinct from thoughts and get into a deeper poise of meditation. Remember that in Latin, meditare means healing thought. That thought that leads to a healing, a wholeness of being, is what is meditation. But whatever the kind of identification, it is to be noted that the knowledge of our internal movements is of a double nature: separation and direct contact. For even when we detach ourselves, this close contact is maintained. Our knowledge is always based on a direct touch, on a cognition by direct awareness, carrying in it a certain element of identity. The more separative attitude is ordinarily the method of our reason in observing and knowing our inner movements. The more intimate is the method of our dynamic part of mind, associating itself with our sensations, feelings, and desires. But in this association, too, the thinking mind can intervene and exercise a separative, dissociated observation and control over both the dynamic, self-associating part of mind and the vital or physical movement. All the observable movements of our physical being are also known and controlled by us in both these ways, the separative and the intimate. We feel the body and what it is doing intimately as part of us, but the mind is separate from it and can exercise a detached control over its movements. This gives to our normal knowledge of our subjective being and nature, incomplete and largely superficial though it still is, yet so far as it goes, a certain intimacy, immediacy, and directness. So he's still addressing here the subject of self-knowledge. That is absent in our knowledge of the world outside us and its movements and objects. For there, since the thing seen or experienced is not self, not experienced as part of us, no entirely direct contact of consciousness with the object is possible. An instrumentation of sense has to be used, which offers us not immediate intimate knowledge of it, but a figure of it as a first datum for knowledge. So it is possible, he says, for us to have an integrated and enlarged knowledge in which both the dynamic and the thinking parts of us can become one, still permitting detachment which yields control. So the intimacy, the immediacy, the directness need not be lost. But this is still as a referent to our inner being and our experience of our psychological self. When we deal with the world, we don't have that same direct and intimate contact because it is, by definition of our mental experience, not self, seemingly separated from us. So let's turn to that. In the cognition of external things, our knowledge has an entirely separative basis. Its whole machinery and process are of the nature of an indirect perception. So this is our knowledge of the external world. It is indirect. We do not identify ourselves with external objects, not even with other men, though they are beings of our own nature. We cannot enter into their existence as if it were our own. We cannot know them and their movements with the directness, immediateness, intimacy with which we know, even though incompletely, ourselves and our movements. So this is the problem of intersubjectivity. If we have difficulty knowing our own being thoroughly, we have a much greater difficulty in knowing, really, the being of another. How is it that we gain knowledge of that person? Are we able to reach psychologically into them? If we cannot get into the profundities of our own depths, can we really reach the substance of another being? But not only identification lacks, direct contact also is absent. So not only do we feel that what is outside of us is not us, but we also cannot get direct contact, apparently. There is no direct touch, he says, between our consciousness and their consciousness, our substance and their substance, our self of being and their self-being. The only seemingly direct contact with them, or direct evidence we have of them, is through the senses. Sight, hearing, touch seem to initiate some kind of a direct intimacy with the object of knowledge. But this is not so, really, not a real directness, a real intimacy, for what we get by our sense is not the inner or intimate touch of the thing itself, but an image of it, or a vibration or nerve message in ourselves through which we have to learn to know it. So that thing is at a distance. There is a thing or a person. There is a representation of that in an image or a sensation, and then there is our subjective self receiving some report about it. But what we directly receive is the image, the sensation, the report, not the thing in itself. Sri Aurobindo continues, these means are so ineffective, so exiguous in their poverty. Exiguous means scanty, slender. These means are so ineffective, so exiguous in their poverty, that if that were the whole machinery, we could know little or nothing, or only achieve a great blur of confusion. But there intervenes a sense-mind intuition, which seizes the suggestion of the image or vibration and equates it with the object. A vital intuition, which seizes the energy or figure of power of the object through another kind of vibration created by the sense contact, and an intuition of the perceptive mind, which at once forms a right idea of the object from all this evidence. So you remember him speaking about intuition and other contexts in The Life Divine. Intuition has then a penetrating, unifying power, and we see some exhibition of his insights in this field registered in his record of yoga, Sri Aurobindo's record of yoga, to which you might refer with profit. He continues, whatever is deficient in the interpretation of the image thus constructed is filled up by the intervention of the reason or the total understanding intelligence. He implies combined action of all to form this point of knowledge. If the first composite intuition were the result of a direct contact, or if it summarized the action of a total intuitive mentality, master of its perceptions, there would be no need for the intervention of the reason except as a discoverer or organizer of knowledge not conveyed by the sense and its suggestions. It is, on the contrary, an intuition working on an image, a sense document, an indirect evidence, not working upon a direct contact of consciousness with the object, and so our limitation. But since the image or vibration is a defective and summary documentation, and the intuition itself, limited and communicated through an obscure medium, acting in a blind light, the accuracy of our intuitional interpretive construction of the object is open to question, or at least likely to be incomplete. In other words, the power of intuition working through these agencies, these senses, the power of mind, the power of life, the powers, the inner senses of the body, diminish and dilute the power of the intuition and prevent it from delivering a complete picture of the thing that it's contacting. Man has had perforce to develop his reason in order to make up for the deficiencies of his sense instrumentation, the fallibility of his physical mind's perceptions, and the paucity of its interpretation of its data. Paucity, fewness, poverty. So reason has had to grow as a waxing power of the mind's knowledge to make up for these deficits. But that also is part of the hidden purpose in the evolution as directed by the self-existent Swayambhu, who stands present in all things. He continues now, our world knowledge is therefore a difficult structure made up of the imperfect documentation of the sense image, an intuitional interpretation of it by perceptive mind, life mind, and sense mind, and a supplementary filling up, correction, addition of supplementary knowledge, coordination by the reason. Even so, our knowledge of the world we live in is narrow and imperfect, our interpretations of its significances doubtful. Imagination, speculation, reflection, impartial weighing and reasoning, inference, measurement, testing, a further correction and amplification of sense evidence by science, all this apparatus had to be called in to complete the incompleteness. After all that, the result still remains a half-certain, half-dubious accumulation of acquired indirect knowledge, a mass of significant images and ideative representations, abstract thought counters, hypotheses, theories, generalizations, but also, with all that, a mass of doubts and a never-ending debate and inquiry. So, counterpose the two. Our limited knowledge of ourself, which has some ground in identity, direct experience, and then indirect gathering, and then the world knowledge that we have, which is very much a guesswork, a patchwork, a construction, but the best we can do. Power has come with knowledge, but our imperfection of knowledge leaves us without any idea of the true use of the power, even of the aim towards which our utilization of knowledge and power should be turned and made effective. This is worsened by the imperfection of our self-knowledge, which, such as it is, meager and pitifully insufficient, is of our surface only, of our apparent phenomenal self and nature, and not of our true self and the true meaning of our existence. Self-knowledge and self-mastery are wanting in the user. Wisdom and right will in his use of world power and world knowledge. So, we come to a more imperfect understanding of the world than we have of ourselves. We don't know ourselves enough to correctly gauge and direct our mastery of what little of the world we know. And so how can we arrive at a state in which knowledge and power are unified for the betterment of self and world? And we have much to do. I think that is an appropriate place to set our bookmark this week. We'll have to divide this chapter, which is a long one, into several sections. I think we should be able to fulfill our reading of it in about 5 weeks. Tonight we'll close with a reading from Savitri. We'll take up a section in Book 2, The Book of the Traveler of the Worlds, Canto 11, Kingdoms and Godheads of the Greater Mind. The all-containing was contained in form. Oneness was carved into units measurable. The limitless built into a cosmic sum. Unending space was beaten into a curve. Indivisible time into small minutes cut. The infinitesimal masked to keep secure the mystery of the formless cast into form. Invincibly their craft devised for use the magic of sequent number and signs spell. Design's miraculous potency was caught, laden with beauty and significance, and by the determining mandate of their gaze, figure and quality equating joined in an inextricable identity. On each event, they stamped its curves of law and its trust and charge of burdened circumstance. A free and divine incident no more, at each moment willed or adventure of the soul, it lengthened a fate-bound mysterious chain, a line foreseen of an immutable plan, one step more in necessity's long march. A term was set for every eager power, restraining its will to monopolize the world, a groove of bronze prescribed for force and act, and shown to each moment its appointed place, forewilled inalterably in the spiral, huge time loop fugitive from eternity. Inevitable their thoughts like links of fate, imposed on the leap and lightning race of mind, and on the frail fortuitous flux of life, and on the liberty of atomic things, immutable cause and adamant consequence. Idea gave up the plastic infinity to which it was born, and now traced out instead small separate steps of chainwork in a plot. Immortal ones, now tied to birth and end, torn from its immediacy of errorless sight, knowledge was rebuilt from cells of inference into a fixed body, flask and perishable. Thus bound, it grew, but could not last, and broke, and to a new thinking's body left its place. A cage for the infinite's great-eyed seraphim thoughts was closed with a crisscross of world laws for bars, and hedged into a curt horizon's arc, the irised vision of the ineffable. A timeless spirit was made the slave of the hours. The unbound was cast into a prison of birth to make a world that mind could grasp and rule. On an earth which looked towards a thousand suns, that the created might grow nature's lord, and matter's depths be illumined with a soul, they tied to date and norm and finite scope the million-mysteried movement of the One. May you find only that one in your experience. Namaste, Jai Ma.